your work life, all of our work lives. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Whether you call it telecommuting or remote work or working from home, workers like it. Or at least many do, because they get to avoid the commute, which is getting ever more horrendous, at least here in the Bay Area, and because they can work on their own schedule. And bosses like workers to work remotely because it saves real estate and enables them to retain good workers who are grateful not to have to cope with that aforementioned commute. And, of course, they get to employ people in low-cost countries if they have a somewhat, at least, remote workforce. And yet, many, if not most, workplaces still insist on seeing employees' butts in the chair 5 days a week so they can monitor them, making it a little easier to communicate, and build esprit de corps. And many workers like working in the workplace because they like socializing, or they don't want to be out of sight, out of mind when it comes time for promotions or cool plum assignments. And they welcome the support of coworkers, even if it's just the IT people being on site. Well, what are some of the less obvious pros and cons of remote working for workers, for teams, and for managers? What are the keys to making remote work work? How can you convince your boss, or if you're the boss, convince your workers that remote work is a good thing? With me to address such questions is the author of a new book called Working Together Anywhere. Subtitle, A Handbook on Working Remotely Successfully for Individuals, Teams, and Managers. Lizette Sutherland, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Thanks. I'm thrilled to be here.
I'm glad to have you. So, I just mentioned a number of reasons why workers don't like working at home. If you were a manager trying to convince such an employee to try remote work, how would you do so if the worker's objection is, and let's take them one at a time, well, you know, being at home is more distracting for me.
Indeed, it is. It can be distracting for some people, and a lot of people don't like it. There are a number of workspaces available, like co-working spaces, which especially in the Bay Area are pretty much everywhere. There are offices for rent, and one of the more creative solutions that I've seen is workers who are going to client offices and working from their client's office, that which gives them more face time, or actually getting together with other people in the same situation and working from different people's homes or different locations together.
Those make good sense. And in many situations, however, the worker is going to decide to, the manager says, you're going to be working at home, we don't have co-working spaces, et cetera, et cetera. You know, we have confidentiality, so I don't want you in a cafe where maybe. What would you say to the person, if you're the manager, and you're trying to convince them, let's try remote work working from home, and they say, oh my God, I have all these distractions, I have my baby, I'd be tempted to watch TV, I'm going to go out to go shopping, do yoga. What would you say, could you say anything to that employee that would encourage them to try working at home?
Well, one, I would say try it in small chunks so that it's safe to fail and that people can get used to it. There's not a lot of people, I would say that this situation is highly unusual, of course, because most people really want the freedom to be working from wherever they're most productive. And I would say I would really encourage people to experiment with different workspaces and trying to set up places. You know, a lot of times people don't actually have a place in their homes where they could do the work. So then I would say experiment with other people's homes. A lot of people are gone for the day, so maybe you want to go into somebody else's home to try it out. But definitely just experimentation with different locations. And it would be strange if an employer forced somebody to work from their own home based on confidentiality reasons.
Fair enough.
You know, and doesn't give them the proper setup.
Yep, and there certainly are a ton of people today working in cafes. Yeah, I'm sure the cafe owner is not so thrilled with having that real estate being used up and maybe selling one cup of tea or something, but certainly there's a lot of people who are working from cafes. Let's say I'm the worker and I have another objection, and this is certainly, I know it's common. They say, I don't want to work at home because I really like the social environment of my workplace. Of course I'm going to work hard, but when we take breaks, I can talk with people at the water cooler. What would you say if you're the manager to that worker who likes the idea of the social aspect of the workplace?
Indeed, loneliness is a big factor for a lot of people when they're working remotely or working from home. So people do really like that social aspect of coming into the office. And what I would say there is there are many places where you can be social and work done, like cafes, what you said, being around people during the day. Hotel lobbies are now setting up a lot of different co-working spaces. So going into a hotel lobby, going someplace public, can just really help those extroverts who like to be around people. And what the bonus is, you get to choose at that point who you are around and who you socialize with. Whereas when you go to the office, you know, you're limited to the people that are at the office. And some of us like our colleagues more than others. Ideally, we like our colleagues. But in the non-ideal situation, you know, we get to choose. So it actually can be a benefit.
I can see that for sure. I'm just starting out with the, you know, I talked about the benefits, but, you know, it's always more interesting for my listeners to hear about objections and countering of objections, which is why I'm doing this. So another objection. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I do have one other one that's quite unusual, and there are now, instead of physical co-working spaces, there are now virtual co-working spaces that are popping up. So you can actually go to a virtual office and interact with your colleagues virtually. So it's a little bit less, you know, for an extrovert, it's a little bit more fun to be around people in the flesh. But if that's not possible, a virtual co-working space can be a really, really good option.
Interesting. Do you know the name of one? Is there a website that people can go to find one, or is there a portal that looks that curates a bunch of them, or no?
There is. There I do have a page on my website, collaborationsuperpowers.com/tools. You can look for virtual co-working spaces, but my very favorite virtual co-working tool is called Sococo, S-O-C-O-C-O. And they have a fantastic setup for that.
Great, thanks. So now, again, I'm still this employee who's resisting working from home. And my fear is that if I'm out of sight, I'm going to be out of mind. That's what I said in the introduction. When it comes time for a promotion or a plum assignment, how, if you're the manager, what do you do to assuage my fears?
Indeed, out of sight, out of mind is definitely a huge concern, but because that is the case in these things. So what we try to do when we're working remotely now is we need to create some form of presence. And that means using video quite often, so we can have actual work sessions together using video. Programmers have been doing this for ages. They call it pair programming or mob programming, which is not exactly the same, but it's somewhat similar. And then there's also telepresence and these virtual co-working spaces. So there are ways that you can simulate being at the office online. And people don't quite know about these tools yet, but they are becoming more and more popular.
How's telepresence? That's been around for a long time. I remember, I think it was Cisco put it out originally. How is it different from Google Hangout or Skype or Zoom?
Well, there are different kinds of telepresence. So there are telepresence like Cisco where there's telepresence rooms, which have basically big monitors or big TVs that that bring the remote people there into the room, sort of almost in person size, so you're not just like a little box on a wall somewhere. But there's also now the drivable telepresence robots, or even one called the Kubi, which is just a portable telepresence robot, and that allows you to beam in just like on Skype or other video tools, but now you have the power to move yourself using the arrow keys on your keyboard. And so if you're, you know, if you have most of your office who's in person and you're the only remote employee, then a telepresence robot can be a surprisingly good solution for that scenario.
You know, when you said moving, the reason I hate, so I have a lot of clients who I work with on Skype or Google Hangout or Zoom, but I kind of unconsciously cringe because then I'm planted in my chair for an hour. And whereas when you said the word move, if there was a robot that enabled me to walk around so that I wasn't planted in my chair, you know, they always say that sitting is the new smoking. Either that robot doesn't enable you to kind of move around and follow you as you walk around a room, does it?
No, what you do is you control it using the arrow keys on your keyboard, and it drives around various rooms. Or with the Kubi, you know, you can move yourself from left to right or shake your head so that you're nodding yes or nodding no. So it actually gives you movement.
But you got to be with the keyboard. If your keyboard is planted in a, you know, I guess if you're using an iPad or something, you can be moving around. But if you're at
And I would say get a standing desk. That helps also.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, one more objection. A couple more objections that a worker might have to working at home is that they like to have supportive in-office staff. I mean, I work at home, and I live in mortal fear of stupid Microsoft, the operating system going down. I've got this great computer guy, thank God, Malcolm Lowe, if you're listening, I love you. And he's available day and night. But most people, if their computer, if suddenly the literally and metaphorically the Microsoft blue screen of death appears, they're stuck. And if they're at home, but if they're in an office, there's usually a designated IT person to help them. What if that's my objection to working at home? If you're the boss, what do you say to me, if anything?
Well, what's interesting is there's a connotation that working from home means that you're separate from the office and that you're sort of working in isolation. And I think I definitely know that that is changing. So if you have IT staff at the office, they should be able to support you at home just as well mm-hmm. as they can from the office. So they may not be able to come down to your computer, but they can certainly walk you through over the mm-hmm. phone what are the things that you're going to need to do. And that's the whole idea, is when we're present online at work, it doesn't mean that we're out of touch with our colleagues. Working from home now is just that you're in a different location, but you're behaving the same way as you would when you're at work. So I would say, if you're a manager and you're forcing, or you really want your people to work from home, then make sure that they have access to the proper support. And, for instance, I'm a freelancer, a solopreneur, and what I'd have is a dial-a-tech service. So basically there are services all over the place where you can actually call up and you subscribe to it, and they help me when something goes wrong.
Cool. Do you have the URL for a dial-a-tech service? Because I think there's a lot of solopreneurs who would enjoy that, appreciate that at least.
Indeed. No, not off the top of my head, sadly. Okay. I don't remember. I don't use it very often, but but they do exist. They do exist.
Cool. Okay. And now one more. There are a whole lot of people, because the cost of rent, let alone owning a home in the Bay Area, is absolutely absurd. There are a whole lot of people who are living in rather unpleasant environments, in which they got three or four roommates making noise, or it's just really kind of a dingy place. And so they love the idea of coming into a cool office. I had I did a consulting gig at The Gap, and The Gap has this gorgeous, gorgeous building overlooking the Ferry Building in San Francisco. And, I was talking to somebody, and they were living in a hovel with three or four roommates in, let's just say, a gritty neighborhood. So the thought that they would not get to come to the cool Gap place with its art gallery and 50-foot ceilings and the rest of it, and have to work in that with four roommates in the grungy place, what would you say to that worker, other than sit in a cafe?
For instance, I don't really find the cafe an ideal place to work. Like, I need quiet space.
Me
and
too.
So when people are around, I get really distracted.
Right.
So then I would say, co-working spaces are your friend. A lot of companies have empty seats actually at their company, so you may just try to call around to various companies that you're associated with or that your friends are associated with and see if you can use their office space. Hotel lobbies tend to be a little bit quieter in some instances.
Right.
But there are, because this is becoming more common, the digital nomad movement, is mm-hmm, booming. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There are now a whole bunch of support facilities all over the world. In fact, digital nomads now have nomadic living houses that they're setting up. So if you are on the go, you can actually look up online these various different houses, and you can go to those places and work from there.
Like Airbnb.
So I would say,
like Airbnb
exactly,
for offices.
Like exactly.
Right. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. I'm talking with Lisette Sutherland about working remotely. Her book is Work Together from Anywhere, a handbook on working remotely successfully for individuals, teams, and managers. Let's turn to objections bosses have, which I've actually heard more often. Bosses tend to, as I said at the top of the show, tend to like to have their workers on site. The current term is to co-locate, not just to monitor the workers, but to build esprit de corps. And because no matter how much technology you use to facilitate communication, it's not quite the same as being able to walk over to the person in the next cubicle and say, hey, dude, how do I do this? How would you try to convince such a boss to allow remote workers?
I always think of Zig Ziglar in this situation, because Zig Ziglar was a sales guy, and he always says you have to listen to WIIFM radio, which stands for What's in It for Me radio. And if you really want to try to convince your boss, I think the number one place to begin is what's in it for them? What do they get by you going remote? So that is a really important question, and to give it some thought. Also, you want to think about your why.
Before we get to the why, what is in it for the typical? Of course, every workplace is different, but what's in it for the boss to allow a large number of remote workers, where the benefit is so much larger that even though they can't quite monitor them as closely, there isn't the esprit de corps? How, you know, what is the way that you, Lizette Sutherland, would pitch a boss to say, yes, you should allow a lot of remote working?
One of the most compelling reasons that I find that companies should allow for it, or at least be set up for it, is the idea that your company would be remote first, which means that whether or not you allow for flexibility, you have the systems and processes in place to be able to work from anywhere in case some sort of disaster strikes, like terrible commute or bad weather or your children are sick at home. The fact that you can make your company a little bit less dependent on one specific location makes your company stronger and a lot less vulnerable to random outside influences.
Yep.
So just having the ability to put that in place is extremely important.
Sure.
But, you know, a lot of managers are afraid of allowing people to go remote because they think that there's going to be laziness.
Right.
They think they're going to watch Netflix on the couch all day.
Right.
And it turns out the opposite is true. Burnout is a much more serious problem than laziness. Most people want to work from home because they want to be more productive. Mm. So we're not trying to escape doing work. We're trying to escape the day prison. And we want to work where we're most productive. And the office is productive sometimes for some things, but not for everything.
Makes sense.
So productivity is the main driver, I would say.
I'm going to make the arc. Now, I'm going to be the worker, and you're the boss, and I'm going to make the case for why you should allow it. Number one, with these commutes, we have a number of workers who are spending an hour and a half, 2 hours each way coming into work. So when they come in, they're already frazzled because of the stress of it all. You're getting half a worker. Secondly, you're using up real estate. Third, there are plenty of ways to monitor people without looking them over the shoulder. Fourth, if you've got a good self-motivated employee, he or she is thrilled at not having to do the commute. You're much more likely to retain your good people. And not only is it going to not cost you more, it's going to cost you less because of the aforementioned not needing real estate. And simply, it makes people happier to have the flexibility to work from home. If you were the boss, do you think my argument is compelling? And if not, be honest, tell me why not.
I think it's a very compelling argument, but here's the problem is, like, I'm going to be the boss now.
Mm-hmm.
If I try this and something goes wrong, it's on my head. It's my responsibility. So if we do this experiment and it fails, I'm responsible and I could lose my job. Whereas if I don't let you work remote, then nothing happens.
Dear boss,
everything's fine and we do business as usual.
I'm continuing the role play. Dear boss, you use the right word, experiment. Of course, every decision you make, your head's on the line, and that's why it's hard being a boss, because you make one wrong decision and you could be gone. So we want to reduce the risk, understandably. If I were you, I'd want to reduce the risk too. So why don't we try it for a day with just one employee or two employees? And as the experiment seems to work, we can expand, and if not, we can cut. Thereby, you're unlikely to risk your job. What's your reaction?
Oh, it's really hard to argue. Hard to argue from this.
You can agree with me. I mean, there's no law against agreeing with me.
I'm extremely biased in this case. But I would say, as a boss, hey, look, we've got a really busy schedule. We have some deadlines coming up. There's a bunch of milestones coming up. I don't have time to experiment. I need you to do your job, and I need you to be here.
And I would say, you know, I would say, I understand, maybe, you know, there's a point you realize you have to stop pushing and you're just going to be seen as very high maintenance and a pain and stubborn. So what I would do is I say, okay, well, thank you so much for listening. I planted a seed, and maybe there's a time that you think for some project or at some point you might want to try the experiment. I'm simply raising my hand to be willing to try the experiment, and we'll be subject to as much accountability as you want in terms of reporting in the beginning, so you make sure that really I am more productive, my hypothesis is that almost everybody will be, if only not because of the commute. And you know how much in this workplace, how much socializing, how much foosball, how much hanging around at the refrigerator in the break room with the free Red Bull and all of that. So I'm pretty darn confident that you would actually come out smelling like a rose and being more productive. But, you know, I will accept your, you know, obviously I will accept your opinion. This is not an ultimatum. And so if you change your mind, great. If not, I can live with it. How's that as a response?
I think that's a brilliant response.
You're so nice. It's Radio Guesting 101. Be nice to the host. Anyway, I want my listeners to have a chance to ask you a question. So, dear listeners, if you have a question about working remotely, especially if you are working remotely, whether you are a boss or an employee or somebody who's contemplating it and have a question or a comment for Lisette Sutherland, the author of Work Together from Anywhere, a handbook on working remotely successfully for individuals, teams, and managers, this is the only time to call because I'm only going to take a call or two. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Now, we're talking about this accountability thing. If I am managing a remote workforce, other than demanding onerous progress reports every few hours on, you know, everybody's got to post on the team's intranet site, how can one build the trust among the employees and the bosses that everybody is at least reasonably pulling their weight?
So there is a concept with remote working called working out loud, which means that we need to make our work observable to others so that people know what we're working on. Mm. Now, in the office, you could argue we don't even know what people in the office are actually working on. We just know that they're there in their seat, mm-hmm. And they're working on something. So really, it's to build trust, we want to go results only. So that doesn't mean that you're spamming people all day with what you're doing, but you do want to make sure that your work is visible. And as employees, there's a few things you want to focus on. One is being reliable. So, you know, that, you know, you can rely on somebody to do what they say they're going to do. You want to produce consistently high quality work, and you want to be responsive. Because when we're out of sight, when we're out of mind, or we're basically out of sight, people tend to make a lot of assumptions about where we are. So if I can't get a hold of you, then I don't usually make positive assumptions about that situation. We just sort of automatically jump to negative. So we want to be able to work out loud and show what we're doing and be highly responsive to each other when we need to.
You use the word assumptions. You know, the assumption, you know, throughout our conversation has been that people in the workplace are these models of efficiency. Well, I reported a study last week on this show that said that they surveyed like 1,000 people anonymously, of course, and the actual amount of true work time was under 3 hours per day. So it's not like we're trying to achieve some high bar where you've got all these workers who are working for 7 hours and 59 minutes of every day. Which makes it a little easier to justify, especially when there isn't the temptation of social life, foosball, and stocked refrigerators. Does that make sense?
Yeah, exactly. And I notice in myself that my productivity goes in waves, and some days I'm more productive than other days. And, you know, I tend to be productive later in the evening, which is a little bit unusual.
Me too.
Some people are productive in the morning. So, you know, it's we have to sort of find what works for us and where that falls. So one of the things that I recommend for teams when they're doing this is that they create a team agreement together so that you agree on how you're going to work together. You know, do you need core hours? How are you going to communicate with each other? Are you phone people? Are you email people? Instant message? And then how do you know what each other are doing? Mm. And when you have that in place, you get rid of a lot of misunderstandings.
Dear listeners, go ahead. Please,
I'm sorry.
Finish. I thought you were done. Please finish.
I think because it really doesn't matter how long it takes you to do the work or when you do the work. It matters that the work gets done and that it's of a sufficiently high quality.
Yeah. You know, for those of you who are hearing beeps, I'm hearing beeps in my headphone. If you're hearing beeps, there's a good reason. My guest, while she's lived in San Francisco much of her life, or at least a part of her life, we're speaking from Australia, and apparently that she is in Australia at this moment, and so I apologize for the beeps, but I think you will agree with me that she is worth enduring the beeps. She really knows her stuff about working remotely. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco and my guest, Lisette Sutherland. What is your question or comment for her?
Is that me?
It is.
Oh, hi. This
hi.
Is Nikki. Hi, Marty. You counseled me about going back to nursing school. So I'm in a very hands-on profession, but I walk around and I see people in some of these co-working setups, and it does not look ergonomic to me. And I used to work, for a newspaper, and I, you know, in the 90s, a lot of people were getting RSI and having to wear all these braces and have voice-activated computers, and I wonder, if someone is working remotely, the employer doesn't really have control over the work conditions for that employee in their home setting or co-work setting, and it could not be very ergonomic. And if the person gets, a repetitive strain injury or some such, injury because of the non-ergonomic seating in some of the cafes and the workplaces, and you know the keyboards maybe are not good for the hands. Whose responsibility does the employer? They don't really have control over that, but shouldn't they be responsible for, you know, workman's comp in some situations?
Lizette, how are employers dealing with this?
So there's a couple of ways. There are some employers that will actually send a health and safety officer out to the person's workspace to make sure that it's set up in an ergonomic way. There are others that just have a list of requirements. So if you are going to work from home, then here are the requirements that you need. You know, you need to have a good desk or a sit-stand desk. You need to have a good keyboard in order to do that. So those are the two main ways that I've seen employers handle this.
Anyway, thank you very much.
But, you know, it is up to the individual person also to put those things in place for themselves, because the employer doesn't want RSI, but the person doesn't want it either.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway, thank you very much for the call. We only have a couple of minutes left. I have a couple more questions I did want to definitely ask you. Many workers, to be really honest, need somebody looking over their shoulder, lest they spend a lot of time not working. And that happens whether the employees are in the workplace where the boss can catch them. But because logically it seems that there would be, you know, so many temptations, as I said earlier, the seductions of TV, you know, this notion that everybody wants to be more productive. When there's a TV around, there's a baby crying, there's a doggy, getting together with friends for a long lunch, yoga class, that nooner with a sweetheart. You know, is there research that really supports that on average people are more productive when they're working remotely?
There are statistics out there, and I don't have them off the top of my head, but yes, there are statistics out there that show in a very real way that people are more productive working remotely. And what I would say is people know that they can't slack off. So, you know, it's if you want to work remote and you're trying to convince your boss, you know that you have to be results-driven. So, you know, if you're not getting your work done, then you're not going to be able to keep working remotely in most cases. So if the experiment fails, you have to go back to the office. And that is an emotional drive that keeps people coming, you know, keeps people focused and doing work. And I would say if you really need to be monitored, then find yourself an accountability partner, somebody that you can do virtual co-working with, you know, where you check in with each other at the top of the hour and say, okay, what are you going to accomplish today? And then at the end of the day, you know, you check back in, okay, what did you accomplish? And there's a lot of software development teams that do daily stand-up meetings where they actually define this for themselves. And so if you're somebody who needs a lot of monitoring, definitely go out and find yourself an accountability partner. They have software for this as well. There's definitely programs out there where you could find a random person in the world where you check in at the top of the hour, and at the end of the hour you check in again to see what you've accomplished. And that can be a really fun way of doing that.
These are all very, very good tips. But that said, it's always better to hire workers who are working remotely, who are self-motivated and don't need various leashes and controls. So, but other than being a self-starter who doesn't need a lot of supervision and a lot of constraints and accountability, is there anything else that an employer, I've been focusing mainly on the employee here, is there anything else that an employer should look for if he's looking to hire somebody to work remotely? Or she, of course.
So I recommend when people are hiring remote workers is, one, the focus on their written communication skills, because as remote workers, we tend to, you know, we're instant messaging with each other, we're emailing with each other, and the written communication is extremely important.
Right.
And the other thing that I say is you want somebody who's relatively tech savvy. Mm-hmm. You know, that doesn't mean you have to be able to program your motherboard or anything like that, but you have to be able to, you know, you have to know, okay, if Zoom doesn't work, I have to try Hangouts Meet, and you have to be able to sort of jump from one tool to another. And there are so many tools being developed in the market. I get emails from people daily showing me new tools. So you have to have an experimental mindset and being willing to try new things. So written communication, use a variety of mediums when you're interviewing people. So send them instant messages, send them emails, have a video conversation,
right.
See what their responsiveness is, and how they react to these things.
You were talking about various software. I'm really aware of the proliferation of really easy to use but sophisticated project software that's perfect for remote, like Trello and Asana and most recently Monday. I don't want to get into this listing of tech things, but is there one other piece of software that really facilitates remote workers doing well together?
What I mentioned before, Sococo, or these virtual offices.
Right.
I'm really surprised that it hasn't caught on faster than it has.
Yeah, right.
The amount of presence that it gives you in an office is really astounding. And then there's another one that's more practical. It doesn't necessarily have to do with productivity, but that is, there's a new tool called Crisp.ai. I don't get any money from these tools. I'm just sort of a slave and a fangirl. But Crisp takes out the background noise when you're on a video call or a phone call, and it takes it out automatically for you. So hopefully I should have installed it before this call so that people wouldn't hear the beeps, for example.
It was nothing. But, you sound great.
Oh, great. It was great. So, it's when we're working remotely, we want to have high bandwidth conversations as if we're talking to the person next to us. And if you have a lot of background noise on the call, it can really get in the way of a good conversation. I always give the example. I had a colleague once who had a birdcage next to her workstation.
Oh, geez.
It's really cute at first, but 10 minutes in, you just want you want the bird to be gone.
Well, and typically being a stay-at-home parent, they've got a baby who cries intermittently. It kind of hurts credibility, and so if you can get rid of that noise, that would be a blessing for stay-at-home parents, I would think.
Indeed. And in fact, one of the things that really gets missed a lot is good infrastructure and having good equipment. And I'd say if there's anything that companies need to invest in, one is excellent internet connection. I mean, that's just your baseline.
Of course.
And then two is you want a good headset.
Right.
A lot of people use their Apple iPhone headsets, and that works okay. But, for $50, you can get a nice noise-canceling headset that will take a lot of the background noise out for you.
Absolutely.
So you want to just make it comfortable on the call. I make the analogy for Star Trek a lot because, they've got those communicators on their chest, and from anywhere on the ship, you Picard to Riker, and Riker responds from anywhere on the ship, and there's no coffee shop or screaming babies in their communication, and that's what we're going for on a successful remote team.
Sounds great. Last question. Lisette, you call yourself a solopreneur, you're self-employed, but let's I like thought experiments and hypotheticals. If you were employed by somebody, honestly now, would you rather work mainly in the office or remotely? Truthfully.
For me, 100% remote. I am. I love the virtual world. I have a thriving virtual workspace with many colleagues from all over the world. I love the diversity. I mean, in any given day, I'm talking with somebody from Brazil, from Finland, from India, from Canada, and the ability to have colleagues like that all over the world. For me, that is, I could never go back to just going into a particular location every day. I just couldn't do it. I mean, of course, if I had to, I would. If there's some reason that made me, but if by choice, I would never do it again by choice. And most people that I talk to, they wouldn't either.
You're talking to one as well, Lisette. Even when it comes to recreational travel, I tell my wife I would prefer to stay at home because I have a window to the world. Every email, every phone call, every Skype, clients, looking up stuff on the internet, and getting on the floor and playing with my doggy Einstein creates a very, very a richer environment than I could get if I was merely, I'm standing on the Acropolis. Boy, that was where they were 2,000 years ago. That pales in comparison to the wonderful riches one can have from working at home, lest I be seen as a workaholic. Any reaction to
that? Indeed, and also, changing our workspace is really good for creativity and innovation. I mean, getting together in the office and brainstorming together is very powerful. I'm definitely not going to argue against that. I'm totally for it. But for some tasks, it's much better to either be at home or be in a different location, something that inspires you. There's one guy that I interviewed. He has a twin brother, and they both hate invoicing.
Mm-hmm.
And one guy solves it by saving up his invoices and then going to the beach and doing it in a very beautiful location. The twin brother does it in a different way. He saves it and goes into a dark basement so that it's so boring and there's no distractions that he just has to push through and finish it.
I love it.
And I would say, I love that they have the choice.
I love it. You know what? I was going to let you go, but there's an eager caller who wants to talk to you. So, you know, I want to always prioritize my listeners. So if you got another minute or two, let's go to the phone. Is that all right?
Sounds great to me, yeah.
Okay, welcome to Work with Marty and Emco. What is your question or comment for Lizette Sutherland, the author of Work Together from Anywhere?
Oh, yeah, you know, we're going to talk about work. I don't know, maybe you're in the modern work. My old work was work, 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 pay the bills, but you don't get rich.
Yeah, well, I'm going to thank you for the call. You know, clearly whether you're working 12 hours a day or four, I think, you know, Lizette, you've done a great job of summarizing all the arguments for working remotely. So I want to just let our listeners know. I'm going to tell the name of the book again, but would you like people to go to you? What do they get if they come to your website, Lizette?
I have a huge amount of resources on the website. So I have run a weekly podcast for the last 4.5 years where I interview remote teams. Those are all available for free.
Great.
There are lists of tools available for people, all broken down into various categories.
I love it.
And there's all kinds of checklists and questionnaires. So if you're thinking about going remote, there's a questionnaire for what are the things that you need to think through. Or if you want to convince your boss, I have a special cheat sheet for you for all the things you need to think about. So there's a huge list of free available resources, and I encourage people to go to the website to get that.
You have absolutely sold me. What is the website? Say it slowly so people can write it down.
It's collaborationsuperpowers.com.
Collaboration superpowers like Wonder Woman or, you know, Captain Marvel and all the rest of it. And the book is Work Together from Anywhere, a handbook on working remotely successfully for individuals, teams, and managers. Again, Lizette Sutherland, thanks for giving me this good time.
Thanks. It's an honor.
Be well. Bye. Okay. And now we turn to you as usual. A core function of this show is to help you. This is my pro bono work. During the week, I am a career counselor. Here, I do it for you for free and in a very compressed amount of time. Usually within 2 to 5 minutes, I can usually help you identify one or more good steps forward for even a very severe work problem. So if you've got one of those, the phone number here for what I call a workover, with no pummeling involved, usually, the phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco and KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I was doing some research for one of my clients and looking for jobs in the city of Oakland in government. And because he made the big bite and bought a house, he's got a huge mortgage. And so he needs to make like $150,000 a year or more, because with after all the taxes, you only keep roughly, you know, maybe two-thirds of it at best with add all the taxes. So I was a little surprised, and he's kind of like many people in the Bay Area, he's very anti-corporate, and he wanted to work for government. So I looked at the City of Oakland website, kind of holding my breath, thinking, what kind of, could there be any jobs in the City of Oakland that pay $150,000 a year? At this moment in time when I just happened to be looking? Would you believe I have good news for you, dear listeners who share those values and would like to work for government? There were 5 at this moment, or at least as of 2 days ago, when I looked on the City of Oakland website. An associate director for library services at the City of Oakland, $150,488 a year. A project manager, step 3, $158,023 to $194,006. An assistant city administrator, $169,000 to $253,689. Deputy City Attorney, 158 to 194. And there was another one, I guess I stopped printing it out, but it was another deputy, two of those. And a second deputy city attorney, they're looking for two of them at that price. So, you know, there was a study, I mentioned it a year or two ago, where I think the GAO, the General Accounting Office, federal government, where they looked at comparing similar jobs in the public and private sector. And while in the past, the private sector pay was higher, which is still a conventional wisdom because old myths die hard, or old truths, even if they change, die hard. Now, on average, especially for higher level positions, the pay, and I may be wrong about the higher level positions, I don't want to speak beyond what I know, certainly for many jobs, and maybe even on average, the average pay in the federal government is higher than the average pay in the private sector. So I thought I'd share that good news. Again, if you've got a work problem, money related or not, all that matters is that it's related to your career. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I want to share what may seem to be a paradox. The burdens of intelligence. We tend to think of intelligence as a pure good. It's like apple pie. I mean, after all, it enables you to learn more quickly, problem solve more complexly, remember more vividly. And yet intelligence does also impose burdens on the person. For example, intelligent people are more aware of a situation's complexities, and so they're more likely to worry or be pessimistic. It was Charles Darwin who wrote, and this is a quote, "Ignorance more frequently begets confidence than does knowledge." In short, ignorance is bliss. And indeed, I remember a couple of years ago reading a study from Cornell that found that less intelligent people are more confident in the correctness of their opinions. Another burden that intelligence imposes on the person is that intelligent people are at risk of appearing full of themselves. And that's really, in our era in which we're prizing egalitarianism, that's really painful in a workplace. But they are then in a situation, if they don't want to appear, show how smart they are, the alternative is to hide their intelligence. So they're in a catch-22, no win. Another burden that intelligence imposes is that intelligent people are expected somehow to always be intelligent. But even smart people aren't always on, and they make stupid mistakes like everybody else. We're human, we're not machines. And like anyone else, there are some people who are mistake-prone than others. But other people are particularly hard on them because of the disparity between their usual functioning and their error. Another burden that intelligence imposes on people, intelligent people are expected to make a big difference in the world. Lest they choose a less ambitious career, they're often denigrated as not living up to their potential. For example, one of the most intelligent people I knew in high school chose to forego college in favor of driving an ice cream truck because it constantly gives people pleasure every time he sold an ice cream pop or whatever. And he enjoyed driving and he enjoyed talking to kids. Also, driving that ice cream truck avoided him having to go to college, which he at least perceived as a poor use of his money and time. He loved to read. It's not like he didn't like to read, but he was reading what he was motivated to read. And it makes a lot of sense to me. But everyone blamed this intelligent guy for not living up to his potential. So that's another burden of being intelligent. Everybody's expecting you to go get a PhD in astrophysics or the equivalent. Another burden that intelligent people suffer, perhaps not obviously, intelligent people are aware of their high ability. So they tend to rely too much on their own judgment. No matter how smart a person is, getting outside input often does lead to better decisions. Even if they're not dealing with, the sharpest tools in the shed, they don't have a monopoly on wisdom. So these intelligent people who think that they're, are fully aware of their high ability may end up ultimately and paradoxically sometimes making worse decisions than people who are somewhat less intelligent but who are aware of their limitations. And the final burden intelligent people suffer is that most intelligent people's career and their self-esteem are tied to their intelligence. And as people get older, they reach their 60s or 70s, aging inevitably imposes a cognitive decline, which tends to perhaps, and I have no data for this, especially hurt smart people because their whole self-esteem and their career depends on their being really smart. So they're more perhaps more subject to the depression that older people face because they see the gap, the increasing gap between what they were like, say, in their 40s or 50s and what they may be like in their 60s or 70s or 80s. Well, the good news is that those burdens of intelligence can at least be somewhat mitigated or compensated for. First, I do encourage people to fully embrace their intelligence. I mean, we do, as I mentioned just a moment ago, we live in an era in which egalitarianism is more extolled than being the best and brightest. We almost make fun of that term now. I've read that in articles. I'm even seeing best and brightest being mocked. And yet, you're being intelligent is a very powerful attribute that can be a force for good, even great good. So, you know, fully embrace your intelligence and do consider devoting your smarts to important things, maybe not driving the ice cream truck. Another way to mitigate the burdens of being intelligent is to collaborate with other intelligent people. Your collective effort may indeed be greater than the sum of its parts. But if you're, let's say you're more of a solo operator, you got to realize that working alone may yield more benefit than collaborating with lesser lights, where, as I mentioned, you may be trapped in that catch-22 of either seeming boastful, or if you're not, you're dumbing yourself down. So there are ways to mitigate the burdens of being intelligent, whether you're collaborating or even working solo. And finally, it's important for intelligent people to recognize that while cognitive intelligence is correlated with emotional intelligence, that correlation is far from perfect. Use your cognitive intelligence to try to parse out what it really takes to influence people. That's key to emotional intelligence. And if you wish, to get them to like you. What are your barriers to connection? Are you a braggart? Are you intolerant of the less intelligent? Do you have a substance abuse problem? Plenty of smart people. I have a number of doctor clients who actually have a substance abuse problem. So do lawyers too. Do you have an overly inflated sense of confidence? Confidence is appropriate. If you're bright, that really is a very powerful tool. But it's not everything. And there's sometimes we have an inflated sense of what intelligence means. If you are high maintenance, annoying, poor emotional intelligence, and you have a substance abuse problem, you could have 160 IQ and still be a less desirable coworker and even friend or romantic partner than somebody who isn't quite as smart. Well, anyway, those are some thoughts. I like to talk about contraintuitive ideas. That is that there are burdens of this seemingly apple pie thing called intelligence. I want to give out the phone number again. If you have a work-related problem or someone you care about has got a work-related problem and you'd like to call on their behalf, what I do on this show, Work with Marty Nemco and KELW, is what are called workovers. I try to help you with your work problem in a space of 2 to 5 minutes, usually not very painful, and the price is certainly right. I like to call it zero, zippo, nada. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco for what I call a workover, whatever your career problem, whatever your age, whatever your sector, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I was reading Psychology Today, and there was a quote there that I thought was good enough that I tweeted it. I tweeted it out, and I wanted to share it with you. And the quote is this: "We are primed to think that there is a better version of ourselves out there just waiting to be discovered. That one weird trick can change our lives. Not. It's often wiser to, yes, keep learning, but accept your basic self and finding a place where your core, natural self can thrive." I think I want to stop there and I'll go right to the phones. Okay. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It is your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hi.
Hello.
Wow. This is awesome. I'm on the air. I'm a small business owner. Mm-hmm. I've owned my own business for about 25 years.
Uh-huh.
And I was looking at how to make that transition out of owning my own business, maybe starting another business, or working for somebody else. I'm kind of doing it for a long time. I've seen the market change a lot, and I'm considering what options are out there and what skill set I have, as I've not spent a lot of time working for other people prior.
Excellent. Tell me the nature of your small business and what is it that has enabled you to survive in that business for 25 years?
We've always been able to change, and it's a a gift environment.
Okay. What kind of gifts?
We do, you know, a lot of stationery, a lot of trend stuff.
Okay.
You know, a little bit of kids.
Yeah, and with the, I imagine you're, you know, once you're doing that, you're, if you are you bricks and mortar or are you online?
Yeah, we're brick and mortar. We've done online. We don't focus online.
Yeah.
But I feel like we're small enough that online would be more of a deficit than a advantage for
Very
us.
Tough to compete with, you know, there's so many major heavily capitalized players that get enormous traffic. No matter how much search engine optimization you do, it's probably not going to work. You're probably more the customer service oriented entity. Is your business, by the way, saleable, or is it basically you're going to have to close up shop?
Well, I guess that brings up a good question, is like, what, how it can be valued at? Like, is it saleable? Do I have merchandise to sell? I do. Can they transfer the lease out? You know, it's possible.
The issues are more like, what is your cash flow, your free cash flow every year, and what are the likely projections given the, you know, if we look at your last 3 years, are we seeing an uptrend or a downtrend, and how much?
It's sadly flat.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of indicative of what things are like in, you know, I'm in San Francisco.
Flat's better than declining. Is it flat at a level where it's a significant cash flow that derives, or is it pretty meager?
No, it's. I think it's significant that survives. You know, it's been my only source of income for the entire, near about the entire time, except for our initial, you know, couple of years.
So one, what people normally do, and we'll get to what you might do, you know, as an alternative, whether it's a minor pivot or a radical change. But first of all, normally what people do is they make a really maximum effort in one in the next year to build their numbers up so that it's seen as that there is growth potential. Maybe there are some things you haven't done in your gift business that might boost the numbers and be also synergistic with the zeitgeist of San Francisco. You know, the San Francisco zeitgeist is becoming ever more distinctive in its, I'll just be honest, I'll call it its leftwardness and multiculturality. And, you know, in embracing of for example, of marijuana and things like that. So looking at the vectors, those are the forces for change that are operative, and saying, have we been, you know, sitting on our laurels with our stationery, our crane stationery, in a world in which it has long gone past that? Could you in this next year change either your product mix, your marketing, your something, in order to build your numbers so that you have something saleable, which would then give you the money to start your new business, if or have a cushion in case you need to go look for a job and it takes a while to find a new one?
I think we could do that, and I think that's, you know, sort of like what our goal is right now. To speak to the, you know, San Francisco with its left-leaning, I think it's quite opposite the way that it's left-leaning, yet, you know, you'd be probably hard-pressed to drive through San Francisco without having to drive around one of those big box store trucks that are making a delivery.
Yeah, that's true, and there's certainly a lot of people who are very anti-corporate, won't even go to a liberal-owned place like Starbucks. They will go to the Indy.
Right.
But let's put that aside, and let's look about what you would do differently. So you didn't really give me an answer to the question about what enabled you, what attributes, what skills, natural abilities, what, other than a great location or whatever you might have, what do you have personally that might be transferable to another business or being employed by somebody else?
Me personally.
Are you a great sales guy? Are you a great sourcer? Are you a great bean counter? Are you enormously organized? Are you a computer genius who really learns how to analyze big data so you can make smarter buy choices? Where's your strength?
I would definitely say it's not the computer genius. I've been able to, you know, like, I've done this so long, and I didn't do this with a degree in business.
Right.
So I kind of bootstrapped my whole way through it and learned stuff as the way. I know I don't want to be the face of it, being the person doing the sales.
Okay.
I think I've been pretty on point with the product mix. It's just the, I guess the, what would it be? What the what people are willing to spend out the door on your daily basis.
Where is the field of gifts changing? Where is the if you were to look, do you know where the field of gifts is changing? So that would either, now I'm talking about the minor pivot. We could go do some cool radical thing that'll get me very excited. I want you to open a brothel, you know. But you know, it's easier and probabilistically more likely if we can pivot. Where is your field evolving?
It seems that people are getting away more from the individual gift and going more towards the individual experience.
Right. So if I said there were two choices, that you were going to get involved in providing individual experiences, or I've also seen that instead of giving gifts, people who have money, we've got too much stuff already. And so there are all these charities where instead of a gift, you can give to any charity you want and your name. Would you rather talk about giving experiences as a business or rather facilitating gifts as charity?
Probably gifts as charity. I don't see how I could fit in a market where giving those experiences.
Okay, so let's accept that for them. I could discuss that, but let's, for the interest of time, let's not. So if you were going to if you were to create with a partner, because you're not a computer guy, you said, an aggregating portal website which aggregates all the different sites where you can give gifts. I remember there's something called Heifer, where you give a gift and somebody in Africa gets a sheep or something. If you were to be and it may exist already, I have no idea, but if you were to aggregate, you're trying to make your money as what's called an affiliate marketer for those sites where they pay you a piece of the action, 3%, 5%, 2% of any money that ends up actually being spent on, say, heifer.com. Would you like to create such a website and get it search engine optimized, of course, with you not being the computer guy? Does that turn you on or turn you off, honestly?
Yeah, I'm not really that interested in the computer side of things.
Okay, let's do a radical change. Tell me one or two things about you that is, and at the risk of sounding like a career counselor, that you either are really passionate about or know a lot about beyond gifts in your business.
Beyond gifts, I think style and like working on, graphics or design or... I don't know if it would be a push into marketing, but, kind of into that, more of a designer, illustrator field.
Okay. I'm worried about the design field because it's so commodified and so much of that work is being done remotely and in low-cost countries.
Right.
Style. What do you spend a lot of money on? We're almost out of time, but I'm dogged here. What do you spend a lot of money on that's related to style, or you would spend a lot of money if you had it?
I think I would spend probably money on, I don't spend a lot of money on dress, but if I would, I would spend it on things that were not in a sort of fast fashion way, stuff that would be lasting.
Timeless design stuff?
Timeless, yeah.
Okay. So because we are out of time, obviously there's much more to do, but I would meditate on the idea. I mean, I'm a big fan of timeless designs as well. Not everybody is fashion forward. So what if I said I wanted you to meditate on where in the supply chain you could be in timelessness? Do you want, I know there are stores and websites that specialize in those. Think about whether you want to learn enough about designing their storefronts, their windows, their product mix, being a consultant to those companies. Want to run one by yourself? Do you want to buy one of those businesses? Think about where in the supply chain, including sourcing, importing, whatever, and ask yourself, which of these could I see myself either owning or to learn on their skin, working for a company that's involved in timeless design? Does that seem like a good next set of baby steps to figure out what you should be doing?
I think it could be a good baby step, yes.
Okay.
It might also evolve into one or the other very easily.
Exactly. Anyway, I want to thank you for calling Work with Marty Nemco. That's all the time we have. We have other calls on the line, but we don't have time, so please call back earlier. That's always the danger, waiting till the last minute. I understand procrastination, but it doesn't often pay. Anyway, that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Thursday at 7. You can call in for a workover, plus the anxious employee, keeping the worrying under control. Until then, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.